The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Now, I'm joined by two young men now, and I think you'll like them. Calvin O'Brien and Terence Power. Good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
And you are the hosts of the Talking Bollocks podcast, which we will refer to from here on in as the podcast, okay? If I mention it, I'll say your podcast. If you mention it, you say our podcast, okay?
All right.
We'll give you that podcast. Not even a year old yet, but it's already a huge success, I know. So, Terence, it was your idea. What's it about?
It's just about, I always had an idea that I wanted to set up a podcast, but I met Calvin then, me and Calvin are friends now, and we had a good chat about it one day, and he said that he'd be keen to set it up with me. So I just wanted to do a podcast to change the perception of the inner city. There's a lot of bad perception of the inner city in the media and things like that, and I always wanted to do a podcast and shine the light on the good that comes from there.
Okay, yeah. And Terence, I get the impression that it was kind of part of your journey to sobriety as well, to get a project going.
Yeah. It was indeed, yeah. Because I've wanted to do it for a couple of years now, but I wanted to wait until I got sober to do it. Because you don't want to go on and try and help people and things like that, and you're out every weekend running amok.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You want to go on and shine the light in the good, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And Calvin, how did you get dragged in then? Are you the sensible one in the duo?
I don't know if that's what you can say.
Definitely.
You'd say that, but I think we're just as bad as each other, you know. The way I described the two of us are, we're two Labradors, so you throw a bit of energy in there and it's off to the races.
Yeah, okay, excellent. And it's been very successful, Calvin, yeah? You've been growing a big audience?
Yeah, I'd say it has been, yeah. We hit number one in the country there a few weeks ago, and I think we're on this upward trajectory ever since. Like, since day one, it's just took off, and it's grown its own legs at this stage. And
I don't know
when this wave that we're on is going to subside, but sure, it's all part of the journey, and we're loving it.
Yeah. And listen, you know what? I think part of what I think is that certainly in the mainstream sometimes, voices like yours are not always heard, or if they are, they're mediated through like social workers, experts, all that kind of thing. But that you don't actually, young working class men don't get to talk for themselves possibly enough is part of the thing, isn't it? Mm. So I know that like you deal with the issues and the generalities of things, and then woven through it all the time, Terence, is your own stories as well and your own experience. So tell me about your upbringing and the situation you grew up in and everything, Terence.
Yeah, it was tough growing up. I had a tough childhood. Now, probably not to some people, but in my opinion, it was a tough childhood, and it was hard coming up and surrounded by drink and drugs and things like that, you know, and it's easy to become a product of your environment, and especially in the areas we grew up in and things like that, and that's sort of what happened to me then. I went down a bad road with drink and drugs and doing other things and partying. And
so you grew up in Dorset Street flats,
yeah.
And who was in the house?
There was me, my mother, my two brothers, and my father died when I was young. So he was gone then. Then my ma has a husband now, so he was there with us while we were young as well. And yeah, I was surrounded by drink and drugs, and it wasn't a nice environment to grow up in, but that's all changed now for them and also for me.
Yeah. Okay, so like you grew up, your mother would you say not really emotionally nurturing you and stuff?
Yeah,
when you were
that's
up,
exactly
yeah,
what
yeah.
I'd say. She was a chronic alcoholic, but it's not her fault either. It's,
yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And then how was school for you?
Not great. Didn't last very long in school. In secondary school, anyways, went to primary school. Secondary school, I was gone quite early. At the end of first year, start the second year, I got expelled. So I went to a school for, say, troublesome kids, and I was in there for a few years, and that went good for me. And then that was there, yeah.
Yeah, and what did you do after school then?
I went to FOSS, went to a couple of different FOSSes actually, because it couldn't last there either. I have ADHD, was diagnosed with that at a young age.
Okay.
And I struggled to cope with it, and the only way I knew how to show emotion was through anger. And I used to get myself into an awful lot of trouble years ago. So then in FOSS, I obviously got kicked out there as well and went down the road of drinking, drugs and partying and things like that.
Yeah.
And then I got my first job at about 21, and I was in there for a good while. I'm still there now. I'm just out at the minute due to mental health grounds. But I was in there for a few years as well, and hoping to get back soon enough.
Yeah. Okay. The ADHD, How does that affect you?
Like, it's just, I don't think it does as much anymore. I'm actually starting counselling now, so I'm going to counselling and things like that, so I'm learning to cope with things like that. But I've a very I wouldn't say I react well to authority when I was younger.
Okay.
You know, and very fidgety, very, you know, just a lack of concentration, really.
And when did the drinking drugs start then?
Yeah, early enough, probably about 16, 17 years of age, that would have started the partying days. Okay. Yeah.
And would that have been unusual?
To do drinking drugs at that age?
Yeah.
No, not in the area we grew up in. A lot of people go down that route. Yeah. And again, it's not their fault either. It's, we become a product of our environment. You grow up and you see the lads doing it and you see other people doing it and you think, oh, it's quite normal, you know? And then that's when you'll dabble in it because you say, oh, I've seen the lads doing it and they're all right. They seem to be all right. So then you try it and then you get caught and go down the wrong route. And it's easy to go down the wrong route in that game.
Yeah. Okay, Calvin. What about you? You grew up. You grew up in flats as well.
I grew up in Lord's House, just off Shamrock Dairy Street. But them flats were knocked down about 10-11 years ago, maybe. So okay. I'm still in that area now. So I live in the houses that were built to replace them flats.
Okay. And how was your background and your family? And all
yeah, I had a good upbringing. There wasn't like drinking drugs involved in the household or anything like that. I had a good upbringing. I suppose it's when I hit my teenagers, you know, when you go down that crossroad and you see like your mates are drifting one way and you're drifting the other.
Yeah.
So like Taryn said, I had trouble in school as well. Now I seen out school, I finished and I'd done the leaving cert, but it was horrible. I hated going in every day. And what makes it even worse is you see your friends who have dropped out of school and they're in fuss. They're getting 180 quid a week, whereas you're sitting in school there and you're getting hassled off a teacher because your toys aren't crooked.
Yeah.
And like, well, am I the bigger fool and the bigger age if I sit through this while they're out getting paid and I still have to put up my hand and ask, can I go to the toilet? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So,
but you stuck with it, yeah?
Yeah, I don't know.
What was it about you, do you think?
I'm a very stubborn person. And I had a very bad relationship with my teachers. Like, one example I always bring up is I was told in front of my whole year by the teacher that I'd never make it anywhere. So that kind of stuck with me. I had a bit of chip on my shoulder about that. And I was like, well, I'm going to go and succeed just to spite him. But it's very easy for somebody to take that negative criticism and use it as an excuse and say, well, look, nothing's expected of me, so I'm going to go down this wrong road.
And is that common, would you say?
Very common.
Where you come from, that there's no expectations.
Some of the most intelligent people I've ever seen have gone down the wrong road and they are very creative. And you look back at them now and you think, do you know what? That was a waste of talent. If they just had an arm around them and were told, like, this is how you focus, this is how you can focus your energy into a project or something like that. They could achieve something fantastic. But you say something to another person and you criticise them in front of people and you make a show of them, they just become another statistic. And I think back then, teachers didn't care because if you had 30 people and 5 of them were paying attention, they didn't really care about the rest of them. And if a few of them were acting the missing, they kind of just... they let them fall by the wayside. Now, I think that's all
you can see
now.
How that it's tricky for the teacher as well. 100%. Like, if you've 25 guys who are kind of have an attitude and everything, and there's 5 who seem like they want to get somewhere.
Yeah, 100%. But I think it's changing now because I actually know teachers and teachers my age and younger, and they're telling me about how they're dealing with their classrooms and the mechanisms they're putting into place. And they deal with individuals on an individual basis, more one-to-one. Like, well, this is how this person focuses, or this is how I'll get the best out of this fella. And they do that on an individual basis. Whereas it was like, right, when I was in school, it was like, right, everybody open your books to page 31, do them 10 questions. And if you don't do them, oh, you're a problem. Like, you know?
And presumably it's about resources as well. And the teachers having the time and space for you as well. Like,
Well, yeah, you could say that. Yeah. But I don't know. I think it was maybe it was a shift in attitude. You know, people are more focused on less institutionalising kids, and it's more on that person's psyche and their mental health, and be like, well, maybe this child is coming from a troublesome background.
Yeah.
You don't know what that child's going home to. So that child is coming in and they're angry and they're reacting poorly. It's not helping when you're on the case then.
Yeah. No, it's interesting that thing you say about, like, and I think they've proven this, like, that if you have high expectations of you growing up, you've better life outcomes than if there are low expectations of you, you have worse life outcomes. You went on to college then, what did you do?
I done computer science in NCI. So I'd say if you look back on my year, I done my leaving cert in 2012. I'd say if you look back on that year, would I be in the top 10 people in my year chosen to succeed? Probably not. I went on to college, graduated, I walked straight into a job. I had a job lined up before I even got my degree. And then I haven't looked back since.
And you work in a big tech company?
I work in a big tech company at the moment, yeah, and I love it. And when I got that job, I remember looking back and saying, do you know what, this is exactly what I wanted when I finished school. If I look back on myself at 18 years of age and I said, this is where you're going to be when you're going to graduate, you're going to get a degree, you're going to be in one of the biggest tech companies in the world, I would have laughed at you.
Really, yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
And what happened in between? You obviously settled when you went into college, or something about it worked for you, yeah?
Yeah, I think the thing that really helped in college is the fact that it's on you to succeed in college. No one, like, if you don't show up, no one's going to hassle you about not showing up. It's on you, and the pressure is on your shoulders. So if you don't show up to a lecture at 9 o'clock, right, that's grand. You missed that lecture. Whereas if you, in school, if you show up at 9:02, you're getting detention and there's a teacher on your neck.
Yeah.
But in college, it's more down to the individual.
Your personal responsibility, yeah.
You have to apply yourself more. And I think I just flourished in that.
Where did you go to college?
The National College of Ireland in IFSC.
Okay, and were there a lot of other kids from your area in college there?
There was a handful, and that's something that I try and shine a light on, that there's not many people in my area who go on to college, and I think they need to realise the opportunity is there. Like, you go to college, you get a job, like you get a serious income out of that, and there is other options, there's careers to be made there.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying if you don't go to college you're a failure, but what I am saying is it's definitely an avenue you should consider.
And is there an element of that? You know, they talk about girls now growing up, that if you can see it, you can be it. Is there an element, Terence, like if you come from where you come from? And look, I'm very conscious of not, I don't want to stereotype anything or be condescending or anything, like I don't know where you came from. Is there an element of that there aren't role models enough? You don't see enough guys you know or their older brothers go to college and get...
Yeah, there is, definitely 100%, because as Calvin said, there's not a lot of people that actually do go on to college and do go on to work. It's too easy to see the lads that are making money. It's too easy to look to that way and say, this is easy.
And who are they?
Just the boys from the area and things like that. And you grow up and you see the lads making money.
Okay.
You think, what's the point in going to college, studying, doing all that to make the same amount of money that they're going to make? We're not even doing that.
And especially when you do go down that avenue, you're being hassled. Like, people are saying, oh, well, he'll probably drop out, or there's barricades put in your way, you know, like things like trying to apply for a job and you have to change your address. You're not going to get hired if you're from these areas. So then barricades are in your way. You're thinking, well, what's the point? Nothing's expected of me, so why should I try and change that?
Yeah, yeah. And you never went down the route of the partying or drinking or driving Calvin?
I dabbled in drinking when I was a teenager. I stopped drinking when I was like 15. I said, this is not for me. So I've never done drugs or anything like that. Now, I love a party, don't get me wrong, but I love to socialise. But now I do it all.
And you don't drink at all to this day, no?
No, still no.
Right. And would that make you unusual in your
friend
group or whatever?
Yeah, definitely. I'm the only one of my mates, well, bar Terence, that doesn't drink at all. But my friends accept that. My friends know what I'm like. They wouldn't try and pressure me into doing anything. And how I know we've grown as a society is when I used to meet people and I'd say, like, oh, I don't drink, they'd say to me, oh, have one for me. And this is somebody who I just met, barely know. And I'm like, well, I'm hardly going to have a drink for you when this is my best mate I know all my life and I'm not drinking at his 21st. So why would I do that?
Yeah.
And the fact that I needed an excuse not to drink. So if it was Saturday night and I'm out and I'm not drinking, it's like, why are you not drinking? But if it's Monday and you're like, come on, we all go down the pub, I don't say to you, well, why be going to the pub on a Monday? So I think that's slowly changing in this country, because when I tell people I don't drink, they're just like, fair play, and they move on, they don't question it. But we definitely have a problem in this country when it comes to alcohol. Sure, you know the stereotype, the drunken Irish, you know, but I think we're slowly moving away from that.
And Calvin, you became a dad at 20. How did that impact on your life?
I was actually 21
when she
was born. I found out at 20. You know what? I think that's what made me, to be honest with you. The day I told my ma about it, I said I was going to drop out of college and I'll just get a full-time job somewhere to support the child. And my ma laughed at me and she was like, well, you're into the third year of your degree now. Would you not see the degree out? Get a job so you give the child a stable future. And that's what happened. I just remember putting my head down. I put the blinkers on. It was tunnel vision from there on out. And I was like, I'm getting this degree and I'm getting a job. There's no two ways about it. Like, that was it.
Yeah.
And the day I got my first job, I was with my daughter Harper, And I remember thinking, like, this is for you. And like, she hadn't got a clue, like, what I meant at the time.
Yeah.
It definitely made me,
It must have been a shocker initially, was it?
Of course. Like, yeah. You could never prepare somebody for that. And I know they have, like, courses and books and stuff, but no one can ever prepare you for that. Like, you're going to be a dad and you're going to be responsible for this other human being that's coming into this world.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So, especially at 20, like, I was only a nipper. Looking back now, I was a child myself, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when I see the pictures of me, I was like, Jesus Christ, like, how is that? But, yeah, no matter what age, I see people in their mid-30s and they're still shocked and they don't know what they're doing. And I'm like, look, it happens. It is what it is. We're only human, you know.
Yeah. It strikes me, Terence, that like there is an element of generational stuff here, isn't there? Like you look at Calvin now, and like that Calvin determined to do this for his daughter and everything, and he had that kind of steady upbringing, maybe that you didn't have. Like your mother did one of the podcasts with you, and like. Her story, your mother hadn't a chance from the beginning either, did she?
It's like, true, yeah. And that's what it is. And that's something that I thought about while I was out partying and drinking and doing drugs and things like that. I always said to myself, I'm going to break this generational cycle. Like, there's no way that I'm going to keep doing this and then have kids and then my kids will see me doing this and then that'll just keep going on and roll on. I don't want to do that anymore. Like, I don't want any kid to go through or see what I seen growing up, because it's not right, you know. But I know that it's not my ma's fault. As you said, she was on the podcast, she spoke about her upbringing, it was really, really tough, you know.
Yeah.
And I wanted to break that generational cycle.
For anybody listening that hasn't listened, that's probably, it's my personally favourite episode.
Why?
The one where Terence is my episode 23. Why? Because just being in the room, Brendan, honestly, it was palpable. You could feel the energy. You could see them now I know they've already buried the hatchet, but you could see them reconciling, you know, like she said stuff that Terence wasn't aware of. And just being in the room, being between the two of them, you could see the emotion. It was unbelievable. And the amount of people that messaged us and like, see that there, that's helped us. And we know there's people out there who are running drug rehabilitation courses, who are using that podcast with their clients and saying, listen to this. Because then it encourages people who had broken relationships through addiction. So I know people who won't have any communication with their mother or father because they were addicts growing up. Yeah. And now they're reaching out to each other and they're like, well, I understand that when you were an addict, that wasn't by a choice. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, do you know what, I'm going to do heroin. It's a slippery slope, you know. It usually stems from childhood trauma, under resources, lack of knowledge. And then next of all, it consumes you and you're breaking off your relationships. You're not going to work. You're not looking after yourself. You don't care about anybody else. And now people are realising this when they hear it like that. That, do you know what? That's what probably happened to my mother or father or my auntie or uncle. And they're reaching out then and they're reconciling and they're establishing new relationships and they're breaking that generational cycle then going forward.
Yeah. So at your age group now, you're both in kind of mid-20s, yeah?
Yeah.
Are you in age group so where a lot of your age group would be the children of addicts maybe from the kind of first wave
definitely. Yeah, we all have an uncle, we all have a cousin, we all have a close family member who has addiction problems, you know, and you grow up seeing that and it's easy then for people to sort of look and go, right, but look, it was normal for them and then they can try and become a product of the environment, as I said.
Yeah.
You know.
How's your mother now, Terence?
She's great. She's sober over 10 years now. She's three young kids now, me a little sister and two little brothers I have now. And she's amazing. And I had a lot of hatred for me, ma, through my teenage years. And it was through seeing all the things that I seen growing up and what I went through. So when she had the three young kids, that sort of made me see, because she was sober then and seeing how she treated them and how loving she was towards them, that made me realise, like, she's human. She had problems. It was tough.
Yeah.
It was tough for her growing up. And seeing the way she treated them sort of made me think, I know she would have treated us that way if she had the chance to, but she was too caught up in addiction.
Yeah. But I don't want to get this wrong. You don't have to move out ultimately. There was nowhere for you in when she had the next relationship and the younger kids, yeah?
Yeah. So I have two younger twin brothers and a little sister also, and one of the twin brothers has autism, non-verbal autism, and there was no room in the house, you know? So, the young fella with the autism, like, he needs his own space and things like that. My little sister needs her own room, and there was just, I was causing hassle by being in the house, so I declared myself homeless then, yeah.
Okay. Mm. And how was that experience?
Well, when I went into homeless accommodation, it was tough. Like, as I said, like, I'm sober now. I'm sober over a year now, apart from the one slip that I had back in March. And I was in homeless accommodation just after the slip as well. And it was tough because, you know, people are doing drugs and people are drinking in these homeless facilities. But, like, they're just doing that, like... These are addicts that are struggling, like, you know what I mean? Through trauma and through broken families and becoming products of the environment. So I don't put any blame on them. They're struggling.
But it's presumably not very good for you
to be
in that situation.
No, it wasn't ideal to be in that situation. Yeah, it was tough.
So what would be your observations on the kind of homelessness system as it is, having been through it?
What do you mean by that? Like, in what
like,
sense?
Does the system work, do you think, or is the system not working?
Well, it's I wouldn't say it's working, because I was speaking to people in homeless facilities that were there for 2 and 3 years and things like that, and they just left there because they're struggling with addiction and because they're... Like, that's no place to call home, that's not... Like, you can't just put people into a hostel or into somewhere like that and just leave them there for 2 and 3 years and just not help them out because they're struggling. These need help, need counselling, rehab... Or else another way of supported living, where you take a part of whatever money they're making, a certain percentage, bring them in, feed them, make sure they're washed, no curfews. You know, there's women in these homeless facilities with children, and they're on a curfew, so all year round, even in the winter, and they're told you have to leave at 9 o'clock in the morning, you're not to come back till 9 o'clock that night. Walk the street. Some of these don't have families. Like, they can't get out to their mas or their nanny. Some people don't have that. Yeah. So these have to go out and walk the streets with their children, the freezing cold in the middle of December. Like, how is that right? Like,
and you're saying as well, like, that, and obviously, look, there's a lot of money thrown at this, but that it's treating the symptom of the thing rather than the underlying causes of getting these people back on track in
life.
Okay. Calvin, you're both quite passionate about. We should say first, no, this is in case all this sounds a bit negative. Like, part of what the podcast is about as well is like that. For ye, there was great joy. Growing up in the flats, wasn't there? It was a great place to grow up, Calvin.
Yeah, it's, do you know what's not even flats, Brendan? Like, flats in general are, like, when you think of poverty, people think of flats and stuff like that. But I had a great upbringing in the flats. Terrence will agree with me. And even when the flats were knocked down, it's just the community as well, when the flats went down. Like, I live in Dublin 1 all my life. I don't know any other way. And I love it. The community is great. We have our number one support is from our communities.
Yeah.
And we've been back from day one. And that's the thing about, like... I know there's that old saying, like, when one goes to war, we all go to war. All you have to do is look at the people coming out of these areas. Like, Pierce O'Leary is a world pedigree champion boxer, and he brings a crowd no matter where he goes. So that's kind of what we're doing at the moment as well. When you look at the amount of listeners and support we're having online, that's what it is. It stems from them communities. And that's because, I don't know, we have that sense of togetherness. You know, like, we look out for each other.
Yeah, yeah. Terrence,
I'd completely agree with him with everything he said there. Like, although there is we had to mention the negative things about growing up, but that's just in the homes. But in the flats itself, like, I wouldn't change my childhood for anything in the world. I absolutely love that. And like Calvin said, it's the sense of community. Everybody backs each other, everybody supports each other no matter what. That's just what way we're reared. And like you said, when we started this podcast off, the whole inner city came together and just supported us from the get-go. And we do that with everything. Like you said, Pierce O'Leary, we've Gemma Dunleavy, we've Barry Keoghan doing well. But the media don't like to shine a light on the things that are doing well because it doesn't sell.
Do you think, yeah?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think the media narrative about the inner city is 99% negative, yeah?
I don't know about 99%.
That it's a problem.
We haven't got the exact figure, but it's overwhelming. Amount negative reporting about the inner city.
Okay.
And all you have to do is look at when somebody does an article about the inner city, look at the comment section. People that think then they're putting this in place that in society that it's okay to have this prejudice against somebody from the inner city, because sure, that's the narrative. Like, if somebody is arrested, you'd be like, oh yeah, well, that's obviously, like, he's, look where he's from, look where his upbringing and stuff like that. But I don't know. It's a weird one, Brendan, because, you know, anybody can fall down
but
these.
Then people have experiences. I suppose people can have negative experiences as well with kids and stuff in the inner city and whatever.
Yeah, people fall into this, like, misconception that, I don't know, like, addiction and stuff like that is exclusive to working class or underprivileged people. Drugs are not exclusive. They don't care what you look like. They'll have the same effect on everybody. I just feel like we are misrepresented in in the media, when something bad happens, it's magnified and it's like, look at this. Whereas yeah. something good happens, they brush across it. We have okay. two Olympians now from our area in Kelly Harrington and Emmett Brennan over representing Ireland, flying the flag for us over there. Like, I think that should be screamed from the rooftops.
Yeah, yeah. So you're not just a problem to be solved, lads, is the bottom line on this, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Calvin, I've seen you talk about, and this video I saw, where you're talking about the future of the inner city and the regeneration that's going on there and everything else, and you'd have various issues around that.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it regeneration. Gentrification has come in
yeah,
and
okay.
it's sucked the soul out of the city. So when you're planning a trip abroad, Brendan, you look at places to go, you look at Amsterdam, you want to go and see the architecture and the way of life, that's being sucked out of Dublin. So how can you build up a tourism industry if there's no soul, there's nothing here to come and see? All the people who have made this city great. So you have your people, you have the people who sell on Moore Street, you have the dockers, you have stuff like that. That's all being stripped away and you're building hotels and museums. For what? There's nothing going to be here anymore. Talent isn't being nurtured. Yeah. People are being pushed out. There's no soul left in the city.
Okay. So what's happening specifically in terms of the people being pushed out? So the flats you grew up in, they were demolished.
Yeah.
What happened that community, for example?
Well, that community there, so the flats were knocked down and it was replaced with a housing complex. That's not too bad. But if I look out my sitting room window,
yeah,
about 100 metres in front of my house is a big youth student accommodation complex. And then to the right of that, about 50 metres up the road, is another one. So we're literally living on top of student accommodation, or I should say they're living on top of us.
Yeah.
There was a demand for student accommodation back when I was in college, and we're pushing nearly 10 years ago when I started college. There was a demand for student accommodation. I think what that is now, that's a cash cow, because they're charging extortionate amounts of rent, and they're mostly foreign students who are probably on Erasmus and get a grant. So they don't mind the cost because it's only short term for them. And that cycle just keeps the wheel turning. You know, you'll get students in for a year.
And is any argument that like we want to mix up communities a bit more?
I don't mind mixing
now.
Up communities, yeah. But if you're like casting a shadow on where I live,
yeah.
because you're putting this big, huge, massive complex in that some vulture fund is probably invested in, and even the entrance, the main entrance to that should be where I live. So if you turn into my estate, we have the back gate where they put the bins out, and the main entrance is like an obscure place around on Gardner Street. So it's like they're trying to keep them separated and segment them from yeah. our area. So I just think that they look at quick cash and be like, you know what, we could put a hotel here, student accommodation there, but they're not thinking about the people. So we're not going anywhere. Like, we're okay. still going to be here. What are you going to do? You're going to push us out. But in 15 years time, you're going to look at new areas and expand out and be like, well, actually, you know where we pushed all them people out? We should do the same what we done in town there.
Okay. Now, you're not going anywhere, literally. You still live with your parents,
I still live
yeah?
at home. I can't afford to move out, Brendan.
But you presumably have I'm not going to be nosy, no, but you have a fairly well-paying job, do you?
Well, being honest with you, yeah, I'm in the higher tax bracket, and I can't afford to move out. So, I'm 27 years of age. I beat myself up over it. I have a six-year-old daughter. Do you think I want her living at home with me? No, I'd love to have my own house. I'm saving up for it, but I can't. All you have to do is look at the rental market.
Yeah.
There's landlords out there charging people money to come and view a house without even consenting to saying, oh yeah, you're going to get this viewing. So yeah. you have to pay for a viewing. Then you
I don't know, are they literally charging for viewings?
For viewing, they're charging yeah. people for viewings. Okay. And if you look at the pictures, there's queues around the block of people going in to look at a two-bedroom apartment, which is already going to be overpriced. Probably
and
two grand
are the rents and the property prices very high in the inner city itself? Like, presumably, that's where you want to live. Is it you want
to
stay there?
I'd love to live there. Yeah. I'd love, but I can't afford to live in town.
You can't afford to
and
live
that's
even
what,
there.
That breaks right. my heart, the fact that I'm going to have to move out of town. And my yeah. kids growing up are going to turn around and say, oh, when they're talking about me, they're going to say, my dad was from town. And they're not going to be able to say the same thing.
Yeah. In fairness, no, you'd admit that, like, a lot of people who are, like, from different places don't all get
yeah.
to live in the same
and
place
hard,
they grew up in. Like, that's
a,
it's a hard
because,
one for all communities,
yeah,
I
because
think.
Because I'd love my kids to have the upbringing I had and be taught, like, the life lessons and morals and stuff that I was taught.
Yeah.
But I've accepted that now. Now, don't get me wrong, it's took me a while to accept it. I think that was just me being stubborn and saying, do you know what, maybe it'll get better, but it's getting worse. And just, but the way things
but
are
isn't
going,
it interesting,
to
like for all the problems of the area that we talked about and everything, and for all the maybe what you would see as the kind of issues people have with the area, that's where you want to bring up your kids.
Yeah, because it's a great area.
Yeah.
From the outside looking in, it has problems. But from the inside looking out, I think we're doing great.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, Brendan, we're probably the most disadvantaged area in the country, but we have the highest property rights. So how does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Now, Terence, another issue that you've talked about a bit, and you mentioned it there at the start, is that you have mental health issues.
Yes.
Yeah. What, could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, no, just mental health issues, like suffering a bit with depression and things like that, and I'm going to counselling to get that sorted out and sort myself out. But I think a lot of that comes through childhood trauma and through doing drugs and things like that. And that's what I'm trying to tell. I have a few friends who suffer with depression and things like that, but they're out every weekend drinking and doing drugs.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to explain to them, it goes hand in hand. I've went through it all myself. Like,
absolutely.
The only way to get out of that is to stop doing what you're doing, sort your head out.
Yeah. Is mental health a big issue for young men, do you think?
There's a stigma around mental health, and that's a big thing that we do on the podcast also. We're trying to break that stigma. Like, we open up, we talk about our problems, we talk about our issues, and we say them openly and freely. And we have a lot of people that text us and say, Jesus, thanks very much, for doing that, because yous are breaking the stigma, and now I'm going to get counselling, and now I'm going to do this, and it's brilliant,
Yeah, and it's counselling available and stuff, are the services there?
The services are there. Listen, it's tough, it's tough because I don't think there's enough, but I think if you get the opportunity to do it, you have to go and do it.
And come here, If there's nothing here for you and you can't make a good life, and as much as you love the community and everything, is emigration on the table at all?
Not for me personally, but I can imagine, as soon as this lock, all this COVID and stuff is gone, I can imagine a lot of people is going to go. I really, really think so. I think a lot of people's going to get out ahead. There's nothing here for us. You talked about Calvin's flats complex getting demolished years ago, and they got moved into the houses, which is brilliant. And in certain places they do that, but in a lot of places they're not doing that. They're knocking down the flats complexes, putting student accommodation where they were, and pushing them out to another disadvantaged area. And they'll be left out there for another 15 years, 10, 15 years. They'll also be thrown out there then, and more hotels, more student accommodation will be put in.
They're just kicking the can down the road, really. They're not addressing the problem.
That's exactly what needs to happen, Calvin?
What needs to happen, and that's the $1 million question, isn't it? I think more focus needs to be put in on sustainability for housing. I think the government at the moment needs serious addressing. If you look at the government, how many of them are landlords, and how many of them are putting in tax breaks for vulture funds and rent increases and stuff like that. If our government were made up of the amount of TDs that we have our landlords, if they were farmers and they were putting in tax breaks for the amount of cattle and crops that you had, you'd question that. But the amount of laws and loopholes.
Okay, well, look, without questioning anyone's motivation for it.
Yeah,
anyway,
well, that's what I think. There's no sustainability of housing. We're talking about this crisis. It was declared a homeless crisis in 2014, so 7 years ago, and they're saying it's not an overnight fix. Okay. How many nights have they had to try and fix it? So I think social housing needs to be addressed for one. How the developers that they have developing even private housing needs to be addressed. I don't know exactly. See, this is the thing. It's not an easy fix.
No, it is complicated. And they are spending more than any government ever did on social housing. We only hope that
Well, we're waiting to see the results, aren't we?
Yeah. Okay. Guys, that was absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much. I could talk to the two of you all day. It was great. And we'll mention the podcast name once more. So, okay, it's called Talking Bollocks, and people can find that anywhere
you get your podcast. We're on, we signed with Cole out a few weeks ago as well. So, we'll get the boys a plug there. But yeah, but now, Brendan, you could be on the next episode.
Okay, Calvin O'Brien and Terence Power. Thanks a million for that.